Hey everyone, this is Abby Martin. You're listening to the audio version of this episode, which you can watch at youtube.com/empirefiles. At least 340 health professionals have been killed by Israeli forces in Gaza, making it currently the most dangerous place to be a medical worker. While they heroically stand beside their patients in besieged hospitals, other doctors heroically leave the safety of their home countries and risk their lives to travel to Gaza to help. Dr. Thayer Ahmed is one of those doctors who left his home and his family in the U.S. to enter Gaza during escalating violence. Dr. Ahmed is an emergency medicine physician and global health director at Advocate Christ Medical Center in Chicago. In January 2024, he spent nearly a month in the Gaza Strip providing emergency care to the wounded and dying under Israeli bombs and bullets. While the mainstream media mostly ignores the reality on the ground in Gaza, Dr. Ahmed's account is one that must be amplified as the genocide enters a new phase of widespread starvation. Thank you so much for joining me today on the Empire Files. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So you spent 3 weeks in Gaza. You were volunteering at Al Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. Doctor, the photos coming out of Gaza right now are completely horrifying. Just literal skin and bones on starved children, elderly people. UNICEF is warning of an explosion of child deaths if immediate aid is not administered right now. Can you just kind of give us the scope and scale of what we're seeing in terms of starvation on the ground, and also what you expect to come, and who's most at risk here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question, and it's something that most NGOs are asking. When we were there, we had already understood that the entire population was food insecure. And prior to October 7th, this was already a population that was half food insecure. So basically, on any given day, 50% of the people in the Gaza Strip are not going to be eating to their fill. As the war started and aid is slowly trickling in, if any aid is coming in, suddenly you start to notice that these severe malnourished patients are coming through the hospital system. You start to see people are really struggling with the food insecurity. And the first things that you start to notice, and this is what everybody was picking up on in November. I mean, the World Food Program did an assessment during the truce, and they basically told us that in the north, 9 out of 10 households are skipping meals for more than 24 hours a day, and they're doing that over 10 times a month. Adults are totally skipping meals for children. Children are having to have one meal a day. So we were already seeing the signs of the looming famine that everybody is sounding the alarms about now. Of course, the most vulnerable populations are going to be children, and specifically children under the age of 2. And that's why UNICEF released a report saying there are 1 in 6 kids in the north of the Gaza Strip who are severely malnourished and they need some sort of intervention. Basically, they're saying these kids need to be hospitalized. We have to hospitalize them. We have to slowly get their nutritional status up. But the other thing in there that I think it's important for people to recognize is the detrimental effects of getting to that point are irreversible with respect to development with these children, mental development, their immune systems will be weakened, their growth will be stunted. And so we have passed that point. And so now what you're seeing over the last week, we've already heard 16 cases of children who have died as a result of severe malnutrition and acute dehydration. And the World Health Organization is saying, we're really nervous about that number because we think it's much higher. Those numbers came out of Kamal Adwan Hospital in the north. And of course, there are several other areas. There's people who don't have access to care there. The other population that you worry about are pregnant women, as well as breastfeeding mothers. They are at risk. Their children, of course, will be at risk, but they are specifically at risk. Project Hope did a study of Gazan pregnant women last month, and this was in the south. This was not in the north. And they looked at all of the pregnant women who came through their clinic, and they found that 20% of them were anemic, whereas before they were not anemic. So this is just, again, another sign that even in the south, where we're not hearing about some of these deaths due to starvation or malnutrition, the situation is also pretty bad. And so, I mean, I'm very concerned. I think every single NGO, humanitarian relief organization, they are running around with like their chicken, like chickens with their head cut off, because it's like, where do you start? How can we get this in? Is this still going to be difficult to access the North, which has been the case? So, I mean, it's really catastrophic, and it's just something that we've never really dealt with before.
Right. I mean, one of the most important legal cases, of course, for accountability is the International Court of Justice and the plausible case for genocide. I want to ask you, as a healthcare professional that was on the ground witnessing this firsthand, and of course, the total blockade, right? The lack of potable water, the malnutrition, the dehydration deaths that we're seeing. I mean, it seems specifically genocidal against infants, like you said, nursing mothers, because when you're depriving babies of formula and nursing mothers of water to be able to provide breast milk, that is going to kill infants in mass. I just want people to really wrap their minds around that, that is specifically a policy that targets infants.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking about what the World Health Organization has warned us about. They have said that they believe more people will die as a result of the things that you just mentioned than people whose houses have been destroyed by bombs or people who have been shot and killed. So this is why I think it's so important to realize that it's not just about, a ceasefire taking place or troops withdrawing. We have the total collapse of civilian infrastructure in the Gaza Strip, and healthcare institutions were a part of that. Nasser Hospital that I was at, right before I left, we started to be surrounded by the Israeli military. We had seen tanks reach the complex walls. And over the next couple of weeks, the hospital was rendered inoperable. This was the second largest hospital in the Gaza Strip. It was one of two referral hospitals that was remaining when I was there. And so we took that away. We basically shut that down. And now you're asking the entire population there, with most of the healthcare system collapsed, with most of the civilian infrastructure damaged and destroyed, we're asking them to do what? To survive somehow? I mean, it's kind of sadistic. It's really cruel. And so, what we saw in these hospitals is not just, victims who are coming in from, their homes being destroyed, which we saw a ton of that. I mean, there was no shortage of people coming in as a result of a trauma event. But we also saw very at-risk, vulnerable populations getting worse. We saw people who were dealing with infections that they should have recovered from very easily, but because they're malnourished, because they're hungry, because they're thirsty, they're struggling with these infections. And the elderly would die from them, or the very young would not survive your typical common cold. And this is why I think it's important to understand that this is not just, we're not just talking about F-32s or whatever they are that are dropping these bombs, or the tanks kind of shelling. Yeah, that's extremely concerning, and it's very densely populated, and so you expect a lot of trauma patients. But this is a 360-degree assault on life in the Gaza Strip. And it was so clear just being there. I mean, the doctors I'm working alongside who have been dealing with this for 4 or 5 months, they were all very hungry. And there was no sort of secrecy about it. They were also dependent on the aid. They were also displaced. And so there was nobody that's untouched by this. It's just, to me, it just shows you that the 2.3 million people that are there, every single one of them are dealing with these sort of very tough conditions, these austere environments that are man-made. I mean, this was totally as a result of a military operation. And I'm seeing the effects compound day in and day out. And now we've reached to, I've been here for more than a month, and the situation has exponentially worsened. And I didn't think that that was possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you expect the world to intervene somehow when millions are at risk, especially 1 million children of dying. And aside from dehydration and malnutrition, obviously there's several other life-threatening illnesses that have taken root that are preventable, but because of the blockade, are life-threatening. I want to also get your take on just working in the hospital. I mean, go over some of the most life-changing experiences and most memorable experiences that you had operating there. I'm sure there are several.
Yeah, I mean, I think as I had sort of mentioned to you, I'd been to the Gaza Strip multiple times, and I'd been there right after the 2021 assault. And I was at Shifa Hospital, and we were doing these different programs where we were just basically supporting the local healthcare staff. And so I've developed these relationships with the physicians and the nurses on the ground. They are, incredible people who are very much interested in serving, because the Gaza Strip, for all of its beauty prior to the war, was still under siege. and was still had many difficulties. And so there were people who were hungry on the ground, these professionals who were, I guess hungry is not the best word, but who were very interested in developing themselves and serving the local population. What we saw right when we walked into Nasser was something that I had not experienced in Gaza before. I mean, just the sheer volume of people who were displaced. I mean, the medical complex had tents everywhere, people inside of the hospital, in the hallways. They've got these small, thin mattresses where entire families are sitting on top of and just watching as people walk back and forth. I mean, you walk through the front entrance of the emergency department, and it just kind of hits you. I mean, you see patients all over the place. You see people who are there, children who are running in the hallways of this hospital. And then we sort of make our way to where, you know, where we call it the resuscitation bay. And this is where the most critically injured people will come through. And it's just this nonstop 24-hour cycle of mass casualty event after mass casualty event. And what I mean by that is you've got 10 or 15 people being dropped off at the emergency department because they were hit in an airstrike, or there was a tank shelling, or there was a drone that attacked them. I remember the first day that I was there, there was this young man that they were already working on. And so I just, you know, they're working on him on the floor because the hospital's over capacity. So there's no hospital carts to put our patients on and treat them. So we're literally on our knees, on the floor, trying to treat our patients there. And this young man had been hit with shrapnel. So he was just walking in the street and a house nearby had been struck and the shrapnel flew and sprayed his entire body. And it got to the point where he was so injured that we thought he was probably going to die, and we started doing chest compressions. And eventually he died. I mean, he was killed as a result of the shrapnel injury. And I remember looking up and then realizing in that moment after we had stopped working that his family's just huddled right next to him. I mean, it's his mom, his dad, his younger brother. And I didn't know what to say. I was frozen. And I had a younger doctor working with me who was from the local healthcare force. And he looked up at them and he just told the dad, he said, you know, his last words before he died were, you know, I bear witness that there is no God but God and that the Prophet Muhammad is his messenger. And I remember the dad sort of trying to verify, he's like, did he really say that? I mean, it was like the most important thing for him to hear that his son had died saying that. And the doctor said, yes, I heard it with my own ears. That's exactly what he said. And then the family sort of quietly and intensely cried. And then they wrapped him up in a blanket. And then they went to go bury their son and then go back to the tent that they were going to live in. And so they had no chance to really grieve this massive loss. They took a little bit of solace in that their son died, saying some words that they feel like he died on sort of the truth. And, you know, he died in an honorable way. But it didn't, for me, it was surreal because, you know, they were looking for these little things to take away. Their 21-year-old son had just been killed. And then without any sort of hesitation, they've got to probably get back in line and wait for the food to be distributed. They've got to suffer another freezing night in the cold, in the tent, but this time sans their son. And that was the beginning. That was the first day. Was literally the first day. Yeah. I mean, there's so many different people. And that's part of the reason when I've come back, I've just really wanted to kind of put a face to some of the tragic stories there, to think about who these people are. I mean, there was a grandma, 65 years old, on the back of a donkey cart, who heard that in Khan Yunis, where Nasser is, there would be a distribution of food. And she came from Rafah, which is about 8 miles. So she rode on the back of a donkey. In the process, she's hit by a drone. She survives the injury, but she's paralyzed from the waist down. A 65-year-old grandma. I mean, she also had her lung collapse, but she'll survive that injury and she'll be fine. But she's paralyzed. And I just thought, there's no wheelchairs here. We don't have any rehab programs. We don't have any physical therapists. And she's just kind of sitting there laying in bed, just staring off. And I knew what she was thinking. And her son echoed what everybody was thinking. He's like, she probably was better off being killed. Then that's, you know, that's the sad reality. That's sort of that tragic truth. I was talking to some of the, after the flower massacre with the 5 convoys that went through. And I was talking to some of the healthcare workers that I knew. And it was like, you know, they had said, you know, it was probably better for the 112 people that were massacred. They said that death and killing is probably quicker and more, you know, less pain than starving to death, like the families who are waiting for the flower.
Oh my God. And
that's what I feel like. We failed this entire society, you know, this entire population of people. We failed them. Got people thinking like that, you know?
So I mean, humanity is dead. I mean, how did we let this happen collectively as a species? Forget about politics and states. I mean, this is just human to human, parent to parent. I mean, these stories are so tragic, Doctor. I want you to just like go over what were some of the most common casualties and patients and also wounds that you saw.
This idea of preventable death, that's something that in the Gaza Strip, we're going to start seeing more and more of, idea of excess mortality. In the States, when we were talking about COVID and ventilators being, you know, all of our ventilators being used, we started talking about excess mortality. It's just, if we could function normally, how many people would not die as a result of what we're dealing with?
Right.
And so, you know, it's we saw a lot of shrapnel injuries. We saw a lot of these patients who, you know, children who with this blunt force trauma. And then we saw what we would call penetrating trauma. So whether it's a drone strike or some sort of ground troop or whatever it was, and I'm not able to make the distinction, but what you see is that, you know, you're getting these patients who are sprayed with bullets. You know, they can have large caliber bullets. It can be one, it can be two. We saw a ton of these sorts of patients. And so every sort of thing that you get training on as you're growing, as you're going through the medical system here with respect to trauma and injuries secondary to trauma, we saw tons of those. And the other thing that we see that's only because the system is collapsed is you see tons and tons of people who are requiring amputations. And the reason for that is somebody gets injured in their leg and it damages a vessel or it damages something that's critical for them to be able to have the rest of their leg. In the Gaza Strip, because we don't have the specialists or because we don't have the materials that we need, the only thing that we can do is amputate the leg off. And so we have tons and tons of these amputations that are coming in. On top of that, when we have these chunks, these burns that are coming as a result of some of these bombs that we saw, or we saw some injury as a result of the trauma, a lot of these patients come back and those wounds get infected because we just don't have the proper facilities to be able to treat them. We just don't have the capacity to prevent those infections. And that is especially dangerous for these patients, but also can result in an amputation. So that's a lot of what we were seeing from the trauma side. And then from the medical side, or what we say is, you know, from the sort of non-trauma side, we saw tons of people who had chronic diseases that were dying as a result of those chronic diseases, because it's not just food and water that's cut off. It's their medicine being able to be refilled. It's their follow-up with their specialists. It's their ability to get the treatment that they needed. I saw a 15-year-old kid, his name is Al-Laham, who he's on dialysis. He has a genetic disease that he requires dialysis. If you're a dialysis patient, you usually need to go to dialysis 3 times a week, and it takes 4 hours each time. In the Gaza Strip, at Nasser Hospital, because of the massive influx of people who've been displaced from their homes, we had to reduce dialysis to 2 times a week, 2 hours at a time. And so Al-Laham died because he wasn't getting enough dialysis. Now, that number is not going to be in the 31,000 total, but to me, he died as a result of this war, as a direct consequence of it. And so, you know, this is just, you know, that's sort of, when we say the healthcare system's collapsed, this is what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. We're talking about being overwhelmed. And we're talking about not being able to treat people.
I think one of the most shocking things about the situation, you mentioned before, this is kind of an unparalleled thing in history. I mean, I've never seen anything like this. I've never heard of anything like this, the direct, deliberate targeting of healthcare infrastructure, which I want to get into in a second. But I think specifically, doctors like yourself having to resort to medieval measures, rudimentary tools like men's razor blades, right? I mean, the lack of anesthetics. This is something that should be available to everyone. Having to operate on unsanitary floors. I just cannot believe that this is what people are subjected to, forced to do in these conditions.
Yeah.
Like you said, I mean, excess death, unnecessarily so, just out of sadistic cruelty.
That's the thing that really I struggled with, because I'm driving into Rafah from the Egyptian side, and the stuff that we're talking about is all available on the trucks that are stalled at the border. I mean, literally everything that we need to save these people's lives is there. And for some reason, it's bottlenecked up there. It's not getting through. And then you have both the Egyptians and the Israelis sort of actively preventing this stuff from entering. I mean, I think that's, for me, what I was, you know, really struggling with, is knowing that it's right there. And instead, where we're, you know, we're essentially whatever we can carry in our hands and on our backs is what we're able to bring in with us. And so I think you bring up an interesting point. It's in, I think it's something that I hope can be documented for the historical record, is how healthcare was altered in a negative way for the people of the Gaza Strip. So people who are trying to seek care at these hospitals are getting less than the standard of care. And they're doing it in a way that also increases the chance that they could die or that they will be forever disabled as a result of this. And it's something that is not a, I would say there, it's not anecdotal by any means. This was definitely something that had to become the standard practice as a result of what you alluded to, which is this sort of attack on the healthcare infrastructure and healthcare providers. So it's a struggle. I will say this, that I think the only reason that we haven't seen a more astronomical toll than we have is because the healthcare workers in the Gaza Strip are phenomenal at what they do. They're the best and the brightest, but they also, and this is kind of this cruel sort of way to look at this, but they have been put in these positions multiple times in the past, never as severe as this. And so they've grown accustomed to having to do a lot with a little. And some of the ways that they got creative and they still were able to manage and save some of the people that they were able to save. I mean, it's a credit to them that I don't think they'll be recognized for, unfortunately.
It's a tragic commentary, but it's so accurate. I didn't even think about it that way. Talk about the raid that happened at the end of your stint at Al Nasser, because this was just coming on the heels of so many other raids. This is, it was a systematic destruction of all the infrastructure, but it happened while you were there. I mean, you saw this firsthand. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of a naive assumption on our part that Nasser would be somehow immune from what happened to all of the other hospitals. We were told by the World Health Organization that there's coordination and that you guys will be all fine going to Nasser Hospital. And so I slept at Nasser Hospital for the time that I was there. That's where I had stayed the entire time. But day one, we saw that there's bombing taking place 10 blocks away. We're watching some of these houses blow up and the smoke is in the air. And it's slowly starting to approach block by block, day by day. It's getting closer and closer to the hospital. And, one of the things that, I think I reflect on now is just sort of the blast waves that you start to feel as this bombing is so close to the hospital, and just how loud that noise is. You feel like the window is going to shatter. I think these were all indications that, hey, Nasser Hospital it's inevitable what's going to take place. There were two particular nights where the bombing was so intense and relentless. I'm talking about every 5 minutes, you just hear this massive bomb go off, and then you hear the tank shelling, and you felt that the hospital may not be hit directly, but that you're probably going to die as shrapnel flies through the window, or the window's going to break and you may be injured as a result of it, or somehow that this hospital, the building next to it, would be hit. I mean, it was so intense. And I remember the entire staff there, they were all very much concerned and anxious about what was taking place. And I remember trying to talk to the ICU doctor about it and saying, I don't think Nasser is going to be hit. I think we're okay. I think they're working around Nasser. And he snapped back right away. He just said, why do you think Nasser is special? Why would you think that it's any different than, and he listed every hospital that had been hit. He said, why would it be different than Shifa, Kamal Adwan, Al-Rantisi, Al-Awda, Al-Aqsa? And he just went off and he listed all of it. He goes, it's happening. And after Nasser, it's going to happen to the next hospital too. Al-Amal, which was also in Khan Yunis. And then he said, after that, they'll go to Rafah. And he was exactly right. And they also knew how it would transpire, because it's just become so sort of, it's not a random, sort of targeting of this hospital. It's just this sort of system that's in place. And they said, this is what happens, is they approach the complex of the hospital, the tanks line up there, the bombing takes place all around, all of the displaced people who are, in the vicinity or on the perimeter, they flee. And then slowly but surely, the electricity gets cut off. And then, the warning comes that everybody needs to evacuate. And what was really concerning about Nasser, and I had already left at this point, I had left after the tanks had surrounded the hospital. I was speaking with the general surgeon, Dr. Khalid, who's there, and he tells me, they told us evacuate. Three people tried to leave, and those three people were shot and killed. And, you're talking about people who were hoping that, it was kind of like this test. Okay, these three young men were going to go and try to leave. And they were trapped. They were stranded in there. He said the reason that it was so concerning to them is because you have these quadcopters flying around the hospital, and they're saying leave, and they're speaking to them in Arabic, saying leave the hospital now, or you will be killed, or leave the hospital now, or something like some sort of like. I remember him saying they are even using some like Palestinian idioms, like these Palestinian phrases that are on these quadcopters. And so people were trying to listen to what these quadcopters are commanding them to do. And in as a result of that, many of them died. So people just stayed in the hospital. And then eventually the army kind of raids the hospital and 70 of the healthcare workers were abducted in this process. And I remember losing communication with some of these physicians for multiple days. And then finally them being able to say, okay, some of us are still here with our patients, but you know, some of them were gone, and you know, who knows where they were.
That is, I mean, just that concept, abducted, the fact that healthcare professionals were abducted from the hospital wasn't just targeted. These people were abducted. And we know, I mean, 972 Mag had that article about the Israeli assassination factory where Israeli intelligence officers said, we know who's in every house. We know who the targets are. These are surgical strikes. And they were targeting surgeons, doctors, alongside their entire families. Why? Why do that?
Yeah. I mean, if you ask the healthcare workers there, you ask the doctors and the nurses, and they say it's just another sort of notch in making the Gaza Strip unlivable, uninhabitable. I mean, if you are basically destroying and ruining the healthcare system, I mean, that's just one of the pillars that you need for them to be able to survive. And, you know, I mean, I think you remind me of what happened also to Dr. Abu Silmiya, the director of Shifa Hospital. And, you know, he was abducted, then he's released. And his family is saying that both of his arms were broken, that he was stripped naked, that he had a leash around his neck, that he was made to eat out of a bowl in front of other people that were also detained at the time. And I remember these physicians being so concerned about the humiliation and the indignity more than being killed. I mean, they literally said, I'd rather die in an airstrike on the hospital than be detained because of what would become of them. That sort of idea where every single ounce of dignity that they have is stripped from them. And that, you know, I can't even imagine what sort of psychological effect that's going to have on healthcare workers for the foreseeable future. I mean, I can't even imagine just the idea of trying to practice under the constant threat of violence, under the constant bombing. But, you know, these are the sort of things that really affect them. And it had actually forced medical staff to leave the hospital when they were approaching Nasser. They had heard what happened to the other physicians and the other nurses, and they were not going to do that again. The other thing that came up, and I think, you know, I know this got some coverage, but I was speaking to a nurse who worked in the pediatric ICU at Rantisi Hospital in the north. And when that hospital was raided and the electricity was cut, he was told to evacuate and that the International Committee of the Red Cross would evacuate his patients that were in the neonatal ICU at the time. And of course, that never happened. And days or weeks later, people went and viewed what had become of these patients. And of course, not only had they been killed, but their bodies had been decomposed. And so many people were just reimagining what had happened, and they were being re-traumatized as a result of this. And so, you know, for me, Nasser Hospital is now defunct. It's not operating. It's not functioning. I don't know where patients can go. They don't even have space for the hundred some patients that are still left at Nasser. The WHO was able to evacuate the most critically ill, but there's still people there who are sick, and there's nowhere for them to go.
How many hospitals are functional at this point?
You know, they're partially functioning. You can probably say 13 out of 36, but really that is misleading to even say 13. If you think about it, 1.6 million people are in Rafah. There is Abu Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital, there's the European Gaza Hospital, and there's the Emirati Hospital. And those hospitals are not major centers. They're already three or four times over capacity. So this idea of keep just influxing more and more people into Rafah, it's dangerous and it's deadly. And just the fact that we're saying, oh, people go to Rafah, you walk over there, you'll be okay, it's just not appropriate. Not only can the healthcare system not handle it, but we saw, I mean, I was in Rafah before this war. It's a city of 250,000 people, very rural environment. I'm watching families try to put tents on the beach, on the beach, on the sand, and just knowing that that's not going to work for them. It's not going to work for the family of 10. There's no toilet anywhere near them. There's no marketplace. So it really was, it's just kind of such a tough and difficult situation, but I just feel like so much of the details get glossed over because of how horrible everything else is.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the degradation and dehumanization of the people of being forced to live in such conditions almost, it's overridden by just the sheer horrors that we're seeing unfold daily, whether it be, you know, massacres or the raids on the hospital. It's just, it's really hard to wrap your mind around when you look at just how people are surviving day to day. And I want to go back to this because I think it was a trial balloon, the bombing of the Ali Arab Hospital, and how the world reacted and debated and deliberated, and then it just became normalized. And I mean, is this kind of a unique thing, this deliberate, systematic effort to completely destabilize and destroy the entire medical infrastructure in warfare? I've just never heard of anything like this happening.
Yeah. I'm totally confounded by what's taking place, but I would say that just kind of talking to my colleagues on the ground, they came up with two theories. Their opinion was that, yes, it's specifically sort of the healthcare infrastructure. It's making sure that things like UNRWA are eliminated in the process, education, you know, the school, the campuses, the university campuses, that all of these different things, this is supposed to be eliminated in this war for whatever reason. But then you have other people who just feel that it's just going from north to south, that it's just, Al-Ahli Hospital was a northern hospital, and it's just the military decided that they were going to operate and clear that entire area. And Al-Ahli is just a part of that area. And so, you know, there you have these two prevailing thoughts. And, you know, to me, at the bottom line, it just seems like the only people who are tremendously suffering are the people who need these facilities, the kids who need to go to school and the patients who need to get their chemotherapy or their antibiotics, or the people who are using UNRWA as a shelter, or they depend on UNRWA distributing the aid. And so I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. It's nothing that we've seen before. The WHO admittedly says this is the worst humanitarian crisis since World War II. And part of the reason that that's the case is because we've watched the healthcare system collapse, and it's not collapsed because of a natural disaster. It has not collapsed because of a famine that happened. It collapsed because there was a military operation that decided that this was not going to be a safe zone, that doctors and nurses are fair game, and that the people who are in these hospitals either figure out how to make their way all the way to the south despite being bedbound or disabled or maimed or wounded. I mean, so it's... I don't know. From my perspective, it could be both too.
Right. It's just so many war crimes compounding each other. It's really hard to wrap your mind around. But I guess when you have complete and total impunity, it's like, that's what's going to happen. This is the inevitable result of having impunity, is you just kill all the journalists, you kill all the healthcare professionals, something that would just be an egregious war crime, even between standing armies in a battle. It reminds me of that horrific moment that I'm sure struck you as a doctor, of the doctors surrounded by dead bodies, actually having to make a makeshift morgue to tell the world, this is our reality, because you had politicians denying them that, saying, no, it's the Hamas-run health ministry. Oh, we can't trust the death toll doctor because Hamas is running everything. I mean, the insulting nature to deny Palestinians their reality as they're experiencing it, and subjecting them to having to do that, was just beyond the pale.
Yeah, I mean, it's intentionally being ignorant and malicious, and sort of this idea that this health ministry is comprised of all of these different physicians who spent their whole lives training and going through medical school and specializing and serving patients. And so just to kind of reduce them to this sort of like, you're a terrorist. I mean, it's just such a disservice to the incredible work that these people are putting in every single day. And at Nasser Hospital also, they, like at Shifa and other places, they had to create these mass graves to put all of these people in. And I mean, in Palestinian culture specifically, it's very, very important to go through this sort of process of death and dying in a dignified manner. It's very important for the family also to have support from the surrounding community. Anytime somebody dies, you have a burial service where the entire community attends, and then they visit the family after and they pay their respects, but they also lend their support. And, you know, all of that has been taken away from the Palestinians. So in addition to watching like dead bodies pile up in front of a hospital or in front of, you know, where an aid convoy walked through. You have to not, you were asking families and loved ones and communities to basically build a, you know, to dig a whole huge hole in the ground, which is something they're not accustomed to. They don't want to do that. And they have to throw these loved ones there into that sort of pit. And then you hope that the next day that aid can be delivered because everybody's still starving. Everybody's still hungry. And so it's just sort of catastrophe and tragedy after catastrophe and tragedy. I want to say one more thing about that too. We have, I'm a board member for Med Global, this organization that has an office in the Gaza Strip. We had staff members trapped in Shifa Hospital back in November. They were there for 33 days while the army surrounded them. And one of the things that when we were there in January, that they were telling us is that trauma of watching that take place. So it's not just this sort of extrajudicial execution that takes place on hospital grounds, but they watched those bodies kind of stack up. And then they watched also, and something that they keep mentioning, and everybody's mentioning this when I talk about like trying to have a dignified death, one of the things everybody sort of keeps repeating is they cannot believe that this situation devolved to where they're watching animals eat the carcasses of some of the people that they knew. And, you know, they're sitting in a Shifa hospital on the fourth floor, looking out. They see the bodies at the entrance. They see there's 100 bodies there. Then they see these stray dogs coming through. And, you know, for them, this whole scenario has been traumatizing. And I truly, truly am very concerned about the day after, because everybody in Gaza repeated the same thing. There is a war after the war. And what they're talking about is just trying to pick the pieces back up.
Exactly. I want to get your response to this that happened in early November when dozens of Israeli doctors circulated the following statement on social media. They said the residents of Gaza who saw fit to turn the hospitals into terrorist nests in an attempt to take advantage of Western morality are the ones who brought their destruction upon themselves. Terrorism must be eliminated everywhere and in any way. Attacking terrorist headquarters located inside a hospital is the right and even the duty of the IDF. For me, it seemed particularly shocking given how I thought, despite your political affiliation, once again, that every doctor, you know, pledges the Hippocratic Oath. And so I don't know how your reaction was to this letter that was circulating of doctors actually urging the IDF, yes, bomb hospitals.
Well, it goes against everything that is the essence of providing healthcare to people. I'm not just a part of a humanitarian NGO. I'm not just an emergency room physician, but I'm also the director of medical ethics for our emergency department. And this is outrageous. There's not a single respectable person in the entire medical community or in the bioethics community that would agree with anything that was just said. I mean, first of all, I was at Nasser Hospital. It's the second largest hospital. What I saw was many, many children running around. I saw kids playing Ring Around the Rosie. I saw kids who were fighting common colds. I saw kids who were battling hepatitis A. I saw elderly people who were struggling with their chronic diseases. I didn't see anything of what they're talking about there. And the Nasser Hospital was still attacked, still shut down. People unnecessarily died as a result of that. The second part of this, and you hit this on the head, you cannot bring politics and policy into healthcare, because when you start doing that, then you're going to inevitably develop inequities towards whoever it is. That's just what happens. You cannot bring any sort of preconceived notions, because down the line, somewhere, there's a patient that you think could be excluded from healthcare, could be excluded from being treated, can be excluded from just basic human rights. And so this is, it's not only inaccurate, all of the things that they're saying, but it goes against everything that we're trying to preach about healthcare. It goes against every stance that people took in Ukraine when a hospital was hit or when a hospital was targeted. And so I would say the same energy that we had with the healthcare systems and the hospital systems in Ukraine is the same energy you need to have in the Gaza Strip. And if you don't have that, if you don't have that sort of same approach, principled approach, that moral consistency, then we shouldn't be listening to anything you have to say. And I mean, I have that same problem with, you know, the American Medical Association and many professional societies here in the States. They have not even uttered a single word saying, protect these healthcare workers. What happened at Shifa is wrong. What happened at Nasser is wrong. And the hypocrisy stinks. I mean, it just reeks. I can't hear what they have to say about anything else anymore. They have sort of no respect from people who are approaching this situation with the proper attention and care that it deserves. And so, I've seen a lot of that since this war. And, you know, we say, you know, in the Gaza Strip, one thing that they say is, you know, what's taken place has really, you know, taken off the veil of this, you know, of like Western values and morality. It seems that it applies to some people and it works fine, but it doesn't apply to other people. And so I would say that that's absolutely true about the statement you just read. And it's just, I mean, it's just not ever okay to say that about hospitals and people who are sick. It doesn't matter. Even, when I'm here in the States, one of the things that we do, we have a teaching program in Chicago for our residents. We try to teach them how not to judge the person that's in front of you, even if they may have things, even if they may say hurtful things, even if they may abuse you verbally, even if they are somebody who you feel doesn't deserve respect. At the end of the day, your job is to treat them and to treat them with the dignity that you expect you deserve. And that's, it's surprising that we want to deprive the people of Gaza that same, those same sort of rights.
Especially when it's so egregious. I mean, children, it's just so many children, doctor, and, you know, the American Medical Association, their silence is deafening this many months in. I mean, I guess my only question is how and why, other than just dehumanization of brown people at this point. I mean, because it does not make sense. You cannot wash this away and just say, oh, it's too political, it's too divisive. Kids and babies.
Yeah. I mean, I don't, you know, that's, that, I don't have an answer for that. I don't get it. It doesn't make any sense. It just flies in the face of everything that we've ever espoused about ourselves or that we believe that we were as, you know, medical workers, as healthcare workers. And I think one thing that I have heard is kind of in the same vein that you just mentioned with that statement. It's sort of, how can we sort of twist this around in a way to make it seem like they kind of had it coming or that they deserve this? Can we just dispute the number that's coming out about how many people have died? I heard one influencer say that, hey, you know, we keep saying kids, we keep saying 12,000 kids have been killed. But, you know, in that area, 15-year-olds or 16-year-olds can be terrorists, they can be armed and they can fight. I mean, these are the kinds of things that we're hearing. And I think it goes towards these super racist undertones, but it's also this approach towards that area, towards that conflict. It's just justify it in any way that you can. And yes, the numbers coming out of the health ministry in the Gaza Strip are not accurate. They're not reliable. And it's because they're underreported. The number is astronomically higher. And we know this from respected NGOs like the Euromed Monitor. They're saying there's so many people trapped beneath the rubble. There's so much underreporting taking place at these partially functioning hospitals. And so I hope that there will be this sort of day of reckoning when we can kind of at least say, you didn't stand on the right side of history, but you also were a disgrace to your profession. You have no reason to have any sort of platform to speak on any subject because of this sort of silence. And I hope that day comes soon. I mean, I hope that there is, you know, a resolution for the people in the Gaza Strip, and then we can kind of hold people accountable as a result of that.
Amazingly put. Doctor, thank you so much for your time, your insight. I'm just internally grateful for the work that you've done. Thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity. And of course, Abby, of course, thank you for all of the work that you've done over the years within the Palestinian community, the Palestinian diaspora. You're a legend. So thank you very much.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. That means the world.